You know, when we talk about history, how many of you have read the book yet? Well, man, I see there are only about three, so there is room to talk about the history. Once you've read this, though, you've got the whole thing, and you don't have to listen to any more history lectures after that. But I'll go into a little bit of history and background and maybe touch on some of the things that some of the others haven't. And I would like to open it to questions, because you probably have things that are of interest to you that I wouldn't be able to anticipate and hit on. And so even as we're going along, if you want clarification about something, raise your hand and let's just make it a very informal time. But it has been said, that an institution is the length and shadow of a man. And I think this is true of any movement, whether it's political, religious, or otherwise. It usually begins with a person. And, of course, this is the story of God's working throughout the Bible, God working through individual men and women and building something. This is true of the Navigators. And so we can't talk about the history of the Navigators without talking about Dawson Trotman. And again, as was prayed, this is not to bring glory to man, but to God, whom Dawson really loved and served. And so we'll just go into a little bit of that background of his life. Dawson was born in 1906 in a little mining town in southern Arizona, almost on the Mexican border, a town that I'm sure you Canadians have never heard of, Bisbee, Arizona. A little old town. Somebody says, maybe they heard of Bisbee. One of the Western films, I'll bet. But he was born down there, and his father had come from England. He was a wiry little fella, Dan Trotman, a lot of life and vitality. He'd come out here to the West. He'd done cowboy work, cowboying. He'd done mining. He'd run a general store. He ran a kind of a hash house, a restaurant. He'd done a little bit of everything, kind of a shiftless type person. And his mother was from New England, a little more staid and reserved, and their backgrounds were interesting because they were very different. Dan Trotman's background, of course, coming out of a more ritualistic church, but he was an atheist. He denied all of this. As a matter of fact, he named Dawson Trotman after an atheist friend of his, Berkeley Dawson, whom he admired very much, so he named Dawson after this atheist. And but he was a very flamboyant man. If you knew Dan, he was up early in the mornings and throughout his life, even in his later years, he'd get up early and cook his own breakfast, and he was a real extrovert. Well, Dawson inherited a lot of this from his father. His mother, on the other hand, was, as I said, more staid. She was a perfectionist. And Dawson, I think, inherited this quality from her as a perfectionist. Now, she came from this more staid background, and yet she became a Christian and got involved in a very emotional type of Christianity. And this, by the way, kind of turned both Dawson, I think, and her husband off. And Dawson often said, and this is unfortunate, he said, if two people, or if a person had seen our family, and I'd ask them, which one, my father or my mother, were the Christian, they would probably have said my dad. Because there was a lot of bickering and nagging and this kind of thing going on in the family, which was not particularly honoring to the Lord. And I'm sure his mother loved the Lord and meant well and prayed a lot for Doss, but she just didn't know really how to communicate Christ in a practical way. Dawson had two brothers, a brother and a sister, an older sister and a younger brother. And just to bring a little bit focus into how I got involved, not only in this high school work, but indirectly it dates back much further than this. Because Dawson was in a Boy Scout troop in Southern California. They moved to Southern California when he was 11 years old, a little suburb outside of Los Angeles. And it happened to be that my dad was the scoutmaster of that troop. And Dawson was anything but an exemplary scout in those days. And I found all this years later. I didn't know the Trotmans at all. But Dawson's brother was going with a girl, and we knew this family very well. I knew the Holler family. And I do remember that they were up in the mountains of California there, and she slipped and fell over a ledge and caught on to a little rock or something, and he tried to rescue her and lost his life, his brother. And I remember this occasion, but as a little fella, that this family, this happened. I didn't know the Trotman family, but I knew about this. But my dad, of course, did know, not too well, but he knew Dawson, of course, from his scouting days. Dawson himself was small of stature. He was a premature baby of 2.5 months. He had a weak heart, but from the very first, he was an extrovert, like his dad. He was a real leader. He had real charisma as a leader. And from school days or neighborhood days, Dawson was the middle of everything that went on. Activity, you see school pictures, he's right in the middle of them. He would do things like this was a little later, he had a Model T Ford, and he'd go down through the center of town, sitting on the back seat, steering with his feet. You could do that, you know, they had the throttle on the side, these little old Model Ts. You didn't have to touch the floor. And all this kind of thing, just, I guess, to get attention. Well, not all of that went out of his system after he found the Lord either. I could tell you the way he used to drive around the Glen here on backing up automobiles and this kind of thing. It was just full of life. But in high school, he was president of the student body, and he had a way of handling people. And he would run assemblies that were just, you know, out of this world, and other schools came to him, you know, how do you handle and run these student assemblies so well? And so he would give them some of the tips that he'd picked up. He was also valedictorian of his graduating class, and the subject on which he spoke was morality versus legality. But at the same time, he was stealing from the school funds. That shows you the contradiction that was going on. Well, after high school, instead of going on to college, he got a job working in a great big lumber yard in Southern California. And he drove one of these big, I don't know what you call them, but they scoop up a whole load of lumber at one time. The guy sits up real high, you know, and they race around the lumber yard and park the load, and he go after another load. Now, this is what he was working at. He got in with the wrong crowd, and the pool hall crowd, the gambling crowd, the drinking crowd. And by the way, this was during Prohibition in the United States, where it was forbidden to have alcoholic beverages. But, of course, you could get them if you wanted it. And Dawson, as I say, got into this wrong crowd and was kind of going, drifting downhill. And his mother, who really loved the Lord and was praying for him, knew this, and she was actually sick in bed. And she said, "Dawson, I know you're going the wrong direction." And she said, "This is concern to me, and if I ever hear that you're in jail," she said, "this will really be the death of me. You know, it'll really kill me." And that year, this was when Dawson was 20 years old, he was sought by the law 4 times, not for anything serious, but usually small stuff. And here it came one day, shortly after his mother had said this to him. He was down on the pike in Long Beach, which is the amusement area, and he was had too much, and he was disturbing the peace, and a policeman got him and was off to the local jail or the police station. And so Dawson said, you know, he told the Lord, he said, "Lord," he said, "mother said, you know, that it would really kill her if she found out I was in jail." And he says, "Get me out of this mess." And he said, "You know, I'll really seek to live for you," or something like this. You know, Dawson, just a few months before, had been up in the mountains there of Southern California swimming. He and some others and their girlfriends, and they tried swimming across this lake at night. And his girlfriend was sinking, and Dawson was a good swimmer, but he did have a weak heart. He was trying to hold her up, and he had cried out to God there in the middle of the night in this lake, "Lord, you know, help me to rescue or to save this girl and myself, and, you know, I'll live for you." Just then a boat came by and rescued them, but he soon forgot, you know, one of these foxhole promises. Well, here he was just a few months later with a similar type promise, and this cop looked down on him and this young fellow, and he says, "Young man," he says, "do you really enjoy this kind of carrying on?" He said, "No, sir, I hate it." He says, "If I could change, I would." And for some reason, this policeman had a little pity on him, and he said, "How'd you get here?" He said, "With a car." He says, "You know where your car is?" He said, "Nope." He says, "Okay, you sit here on this bench, and I'll be back in an hour or so." And I don't know if he cuffed him to the bench or what, but he sat on this bench, and he says, "If you can find your car after I get back, I'll let you go." Well, he found his car, and he went without being taken into the police station. So this time, though, Dawson said, I want to keep my promise to God. And so he didn't have anything else to do. He went to the local church in town. This was Friday night when it happened with the policeman. And so Sunday night, he went to this little church and went to the young people's group. And this young people's group was sponsored and run by two maiden lady school teachers that Dawson had in school. And they knew the Lord, and they had been praying daily for 5 years for Dawson. And here he comes into this youth group. And they had just started a contest in this group, you know, about attendance, and you get points, and you bring a visitor, you get another some other points. And then, among other things, they gave him 10 Bible verses to learn, and the next week, if you knew them, you'd get some more points. And the idea was that one group then would have to sponsor a party or something for the group that that won. Well, so Dawson knew these kids from school, and he says, man, if I'm going to go straight here, you know, I better not be the only one next week that doesn't know these verses. So he learned all the verses. And he got back the next week, and he found out he was the only one that knew them. He said he learned his first lesson, that Christians, you know, don't take things too seriously. And, well, he says, among other things, they gave him 10 more verses to learn. He learned another lesson. He says, you find a good horse and you work him to death, you know. So he had this reputation now, and so he had to learn 10 more. The first were on how to become a Christian. The second 10 were on living the Christian life. And I've heard him tell it many times. He says the third week he was on his way to work, had his lunch pail in his hand, and these verses were coming to mind. And John 5:24 came to his mind. He'd memorized it, you know, but it kind of, this was a Sunday night thing that he'd had before. All during the week it was just like before, but on Sunday night, you know, he tried to gear in with a Christian. But he was going to work, and John 5:24 came to his mind. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that heareth my word and believeth on him that sent me hath everlasting life. And he said, he just stopped there in the sidewalk and he said, hath everlasting life. Boy, he said, I want that. Whatever that is, however you get it, I want it, Lord. And then another verse he'd memorized came to mind, John 1:12. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. And so right there he said, Lord, whatever it means to receive you, I don't understand a lot, but whatever it means, I receive you. I want this eternal life. And so he went on to work, and he said things were different. He said, you know, the dirty stories and all just didn't impress him anymore. And he was the life of the crowd there at the lumberyard as well. And so he began to tell, you know, some of his friends what had happened. And then he remembered, oh yeah, every noon, once a week, out here in this lumber yard, there came a young, I don't know if he was a lay preacher or what, he would come and hold a little Bible study for some of the men in the lumber yard. This is a big lumber yard, about 200 men. And he said there was a little handful out there that would come and meet, and he says, they're Christians and I'm one of them now. So he said, I'll go out and tell them that. So he went the next time when this meeting was held. You know, it's out in Southern California. You could do this all year round because the sun shines all the time there, you know. And they would eat their lunch out there and have the service. So he went and told his father, he says, you know, I accepted Jesus. And he said, I'm one of you. And so this lay preacher, or preacher, whichever he was, he said, well, fine. He said, how would you like to tell us about it next week when we meet? Just, you know, tell how all this happened. I said, okay, I will. Well, he made the mistake of telling one of his buddies that he was going to do this next week. So this he was called Pork. They call him Pork. I don't know, because his hair maybe stood up a little bit or something. But the next week when this Bible study came around, this guy and some of the others posted all over the bulletin boards, all over the lumberyard, come on out, Pork's going to preach. And so instead of this little handful, they had about 200 men out there. And Doss got to share, you know, how he had met Christ and what it meant to him. Well, then he figured he ought to be doing something for God, so he went to the pastor of this church, and he says, now look, I'm a Christian, and I want to do something for the Lord. Is there anything I can do? The pastor says, is there anything you can do? He says, we've got a group, a class of junior high school boys, six of them. They've killed off two teachers. And he says, maybe you can do something with them. So Dawson said, okay. So he took the class. And sure enough, there were a bunch of rowdies that just didn't pay attention. But Doss learned something right early. he learned to pray. And he says, Lord, he says, you made little boys. You wired them together. And you know what makes them tick and what can reach them. So the Lord gave him an idea. And he went to the ringleader of this group that was kind of stirring things up personally. And kind of buddied with him and got his confidence. And next week, this kid, you know, cooperated with him. And he visited each one personally. And in a matter of several weeks, I don't know how long a period of time, these six kids came to know Christ personally. And they began to invite others of their friends. And pretty soon, this thing grew so it was far bigger than any little Sunday school class could hold. And they started junior high Bible study clubs. And this grew in this little town of Lameda to about 225 kids in a period of several years. I don't know how many years that was. And it made a real impact on this town to see these kids who found Christ and were now studying the scriptures. And a lot of the ideas that even we use today grew out of those little junior high school Bible clubs. For instance, the kids couldn't find, you know, Matthew from Revelation. They didn't know where to turn. So Doss developed this little ladder, this system that they used to help the kids find their Bible verses in the Bible class. Another thing he developed, he had a little New Testament, and he found the right kind that would be durable for these kids, you know, and he developed a system of arrows. And so they could present the gospel to their friends, and he had a 10-point, I think it was 10-point arrow system, where he put an arrow and he'd dip it in ink. It was an arrow on the end of a eraser. He'd take an eraser and cut it like an arrow, dip it in ink, and then go over into the margin of the Bible like this so that the point would come here, and then he'd draw a line over to this verse, you know, and go right down the gospel line. And you go down the arrows, and you go down the 10 points of the gospel. And he helped the kids develop this. And the kids were wearing these things out, so they found that the Prince Albert tobacco cans would just fit, that testament would fit into them, so Lila would boil these things and dye to get the tobacco off of them and the advertising, and they'd carry these in their hip pocket, these kids. Doss developed the beginning of the wheel. In those days, it was called the three-legged stool, and he didn't like the idea of a stool. That didn't sound too much like a Christian, so he developed it then into the wheel later on. But a lot of these ideas grew out of a need for these junior high school kids to grow in the Lord. And Dawson was very creative, and he had, you know, he threw out more ideas than most people ever thought of. And I've seen some of them. As was mentioned, I was in his high school clubs. These came along a little later. And it was quite an elaborate system of club work. Maybe I should explain a little bit about how that worked. We had notebooks, and these little notebooks took care of different phases of your life. Your scripture, memory, Bible study. There was a prayer life. There was a life of things you had to do, how to get things done and be sure they're done. There were addresses. There was an 8-point check system. You checked yourself on all these 8 points every week. And then in these clubs, he didn't only have high clubs for fellas, the dunamis clubs, but he had them for the girls, and that was the martyrs club, not the kind of martyrs you think. That's a Greek word, M-A-R-T-U-R-E-S, which means witness. And both of these ideas were taken out of Acts 1:8, where it says, "But ye shall receive power," that's the Greek word dunamis, "and ye shall be witnesses," that's martyrs in the Greek. And that's where they got the idea of the dunamis martyrs club, D&M clubs. And we used to have these big rallies, you know, every few months around Southern California. And it was quite a thing. I remember he developed emblems and sweaters and pins and all kinds of things. We used a little bit, but he threw most of that out later. But I remember the salute we had, you know, after the class, he salute all for Christ, you know, and this kind of thing. It was kind of a little semi-military thing. Boy, he had these little kids. We were on the end of strings. We'd jump up and down and learn our verses. But I went for it, and it was just what I needed. Well, let's see. Where should we go from here? He became involved then in Christian Endeavor. And this was a group. I don't know. Do you have Christian Endeavor up in Canada or not? It's youth work in various churches. Like the Sunday night youth activity. They call them youth fellowships now. But it was a coordinated group in many different kinds of churches, interdenominational. And so he became involved in this through his church. And then he became I think they call it something like deputation secretary or something for Southern California, Well, he didn't know what his duties were, so he found a book or a little pamphlet that told him some of the duties. And one of them was he was supposed to get a gospel team going. Well, he never knew what a gospel team was, so he started developing some of this idea of a gospel team. And they went around to different churches throughout Southern California and challenging youth. In 1929, he went 1 year to the Los Angeles Baptist Seminary. He felt he needed a little more depth and grounding in the Word. And very interestingly, one of his professors at that time was Charles E. Fuller, the old-fashioned revival hour who's now with the Lord. And this began many years of co-laborship with Charles Fuller. But in seminary there, they had Greek, and Daw said the Greek took too much time away from his Bible. He was carrying on these Bible clubs all over Southern California besides, and it took too much time, so he quit the seminary after a year. And he went to the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, where they didn't have to take Greek and some of these other things. And they made him president of the Student Missionary Union. It was at that time that he volunteered to go to India. He had a burden for India. God never allowed him to do that as a missionary, but he was allowed to send some others. And all this time, he pushed two things, personal evangelism and scripture memory. You know, he was out of his mind on these two subjects. He was a witness all the time. And, for instance, even he had his motorcycle. He'd witness the guys on his motorcycle. You know, he'd say, get on the back here, hitchhiker. Stick your head on my shoulder. And he'd go riding down the street and flip on verses in his New Testament, you know, and let him read the verses. Now, you know, this isn't the wisest thing. It's kind of like a barber who's ready to shave, and he says, are you ready for eternity, you know? And here's, I think that's kind of taking unfair advantage, don't you? But this was his zeal for the Lord, and he learned to temper that in later years, but this is the way he was. And he developed all kinds of scripture memory programs, because in his early Christian life, he learned a verse a day for, I think, the first 3 years, and kept them. And this meant so much to him. And so he was trying to push it on others all the time. And he developed different systems, and it's always being refined. And this new topical memory system will be refined again in a few years, probably. One thing, though, happened in his life about this time. He picked up a hitchhiker. He was always doing this and witnessing to them. He picked up one in his car and started to witness to him about Christ. And the guy even swore. Well, as he got into the car, not at him for witnessing, but as he got into the car, he said a swear word or two. And I said, say, don't I know you from somewhere? About a year before, he'd picked up this same fellow, witnessed to him, and apparently the fellow had made a decision for Christ. But now here, there was no change. And this really startled us. He says, why isn't it working for him like it did for me? And so he went back to the scriptures, and he got into this whole concept of not only just getting a decision out of people, but of follow-up, staying with them, helping them grow in the Christian life. And, of course, then this became one of the main emphases of the Navigators from then on, helping a person to grow and mature in the Christian life. And it was about this time that he had these 42 days of praying with his friend up in the mountains, up in the hills there in Southern California. And they'd pray every morning at 5 o'clock, and Sunday morning they'd pray at 4 o'clock and pray for an hour or two. And, you know, they prayed for the vicinity of Los Angeles and California and the United States, and they started for the whole world and prayed for countries and places that they hardly knew about, but claiming that God would use them in these various places. And then he got laid up on his back after these 42 days and was sick in bed, and God gave him the idea of a Minutemen. And there was a very disciplined, hard crew, bunch of fellas. They had 9 disciplines. They had to memorize a verse a day, spend an hour a day with God, touch a soul for a day for Christ, and there were, you know, four or five others. And this group was used throughout Southern California to challenge and work with young people. But after about a year and a half, this disbanded. They went to seminaries or schools and got married and so forth. And then Doss prayed this prayer. He said, Lord, bring me into contact with a band of men, strong, rugged soldiers of the cross, with an eye single to your glory. And he wrote this in his Bible. And shortly after that, he was put in contact with this Christian sailor, Les Spencer. And that was in April of 1933. And Les Spencer was a Christian who joined the Navy, was finding it difficult really living for Christ on board his ship. And he was open for help. And so when the ships were in, he'd come to Doss, and Doss would teach him all he knew about Christ. And he said, Les, you know, don't just pray, and don't try to necessarily win your whole ship. Pray for one man. And, you know, some weeks later, here he came with another fellow, Gurney Harris. And he says, Gurney's, you know, he's received Christ. He knows the Lord. Teach him the things that I taught you. And I've heard Dawson tell this many times. He didn't really know the significance of what he was doing there. But he said, no, Les, I won't teach him. Why not? He says, you teach him, because if you can't teach him what I taught you, then I have failed. And that's the old 2 Timothy 2:2 idea, you know. The things that thou hast heard of me, Paul writing to Timothy, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. And this was the beginning, really, where we date the beginning of the Navigator work in 1933. And it began to expand, and they would win others to Christ. And those first four or five or six men, Spencer, Harris, Dedrick, Goodrick, Virgil Hook, then came Jim Downey, was number six on board that ship, the USS West Virginia. And these men have all been mightily used in various spots around the world, mission organizations and works. And about 125 men came to Christ in the next few years on board this ship. And it was dubbed the Floating Seminary because there were so many Christians that really knew how to lead others to Christ. And they began to pray for other ships. And God then would transfer one and get a work started there. And it began to grow. And then came Pearl Harbor, where these ships, these battleships, were all sunk. And these men were dispersed, and of course thousands more came into the service. And during the war years, all other work of the navigators with high school work and all were shut down. It was purely a serviceman's work. And the navigators had contact with at least one and many times 50 or more men on board about 1,000 ships of the Navy and at least 1,000 Army camps and air bases around the world. And men were coming to Christ, really hundreds of them and thousands of them. And being built up in the Christian life. And after the war, of course, these guys got discharged and went back to their hometowns, home churches, schools, and had a real impact for Christ. And then this began a whole new phase of the navigator work. The military work kind of began to slowly shut down, and the collegiate work started then. And up to that time, we had never really had a collegiate work. It had been high school and junior high, but now we started the collegiate work. And then there came these requests in from all over other organizations. Dawson, you've had experience of building strong disciples for Jesus Christ. Help us in this. People are coming to Christ, and this was true after World War II. There was a great harvest, a reaping in many places. Organizations like Youth for Christ. Thousands of kids coming to Christ. Help us in follow-up. So Dawson spent a lot of his time helping these organizations. And they're just one of them. I could name off many of these. And Doss had a peculiar ministry. And in these days, the emphasis was primarily on follow-up, helping a person grow to a degree of maturity. And there was an emphasis on other works. And that is helping other organizations. And Dawson had a special ministry to Christian leaders that was peculiarly his. And in the Youth for Christ organization, some of these early leaders, Tory Johnson, Bob Cook, Dave Morgan, Doss had a tremendous ministry in their lives, and through them, the whole organization was affected. Overseas Crusade, Dick Hillis, a very close relationship. Of course, Billy Graham and the whole Crusade work after that. Campus Crusade, Bill Bright, and our early men that Bill had a staff were navigators loaned to him. The Wycliffe Bible translators, Bob Doss, up until his death, was on the board of directors of Wycliffe, and many of the men out there were navigators, and some in key positions today in the Wycliffe organization are navigators. World Vision with Bob Pierce, the same thing. The Missionary Aviation Fellowship. As a matter of fact, Doss and the navigators offered the first, we offered office space for them. And Betty Green, a pilot who was one of their first leaders, lived right there in the navigator home and got Missionary Aviation Fellowship started. The Moody Institute of Science Films, you know, Dr. Irwin Moon. Well, Doss and Irwin, in the early days, they lived together, actually, the two families for a while. And Doss helped him in his ministry. And the Greater Europe Mission of Bob Evans. And we could go on with many of these Christian organizations. Doss had an unusual ministry in the lives of these leaders and through them throughout the world. Well, where do we go from here? You may have questions. I can tell you some things that perhaps impressed me. and some of the emphases. Well, let me just bring this history a little bit up to date then. In 1948, we sent out our first missionary, Roy Robertson, to China. In 1949, one fellow went over to France, came back, and in 55 of us went to Europe, and I eventually then ended up in Germany. In 1951, Billy Graham, who Doss had known over the years, called and said, you know, you've got to help us in our ministry. And so from that time on, Doss spent about half his time, and then Lauren Sanny as well, in setting up this whole counseling follow-up system that Billy Graham and other evangelists have used. In 53, God gave Glenn Airey. We won't go into that as to how that happened. That's a story of its own. You can read it in the book, or there may still be some of these pamphlets around the Glenn Airey story. It's a real miracle and a real thrilling story how God gave us this place. In 56, then Dawson, of course, died. He was drowned in Scroon Lake. I could have mentioned another Word of Life, Jack Wurtson, his program. They were very close, and Dawson was there at this conference, and they were thrown out of a boat. He helped save this girl who couldn't swim, and in the process, he went under. And of course, this was really hard on Jack Wurtson, who was driving the boat. But we all saw this as God's timing. And then there was a transition. Lauren became president then, and there was a real transition here where Leroy Imes became U.S. director. He had some of our emphases in evangelism. Now, we had, in the meantime, gotten away from primary evangelism. Not that we weren't personally witnessing to people, but we were so busy following up these other organizations and their evangelism that we were really weak in personal evangelism. I think God used Leroy to get us back into winning our own, you see. And if you've lost the cutting edge of evangelism, you've lost a lot. And so evangelism and this disciple making have to go hand in hand. And this is what we're emphasizing, of course, today. In 1961, we had what we called an overseas policy conference. And that's where the leaders from the overseas work came together. And there were three main things that came out of that. One, the desire or the decision to fly our own flag. And that is, before we were strictly a service organization, or almost strictly a service organization, we were helping all these other organizations do their work. And so we really didn't have time or energy almost to do our own work of disciple making. We were weak in this area. So the decision was made to fly our own flag. That is, we would go out as our own organization, not through other organizations only. Secondly, we would define our objectives. What is the objective that God has given the navigator, or the few objectives primarily? And God has used Lauren and his staff to develop the objectives. If you don't know what the objectives of the navigators are, you can ask. Or what the main objective is. And the third was to demonstrate the navigator vision. Now, we had years before demonstrated it, but I think to a degree in this spreading thin throughout the whole world, now God used this to get us out. See, this is all in God's timing. But in the process of helping everybody do their ministry, I think we kind of neglected doing our own. And so the decision was made to demonstrate, in other words, pull the reins in a little bit, become a little bit ingrown, if you please, to demonstrate disciple making. And God has used Lauren, of course, to spearhead this, and I think rightfully so. I think we're in a place now where we can begin to spread out a little more and give more help to these other organizations again. Today we have a staff of about 1,200 people around the world. We're in 31 different countries. Some of them just beachheads. The staff includes 28 different nationalities, so it's not just an American or a Canadian outfit. As a matter of fact, the percentage of Americans will be coming less and less all the time because it's an international outfit. Well, you know, we could go on and on. Maybe you have questions. If you have, ask them. And then I can go on and tell you more war stories if you'd like. Yeah? All right. In 1930, I think it was, 35 or 38. Which one is it? I think it was 1935, yeah. Dawson had this work with the sailors. And they called themselves Servicemen's Bible Club, or something like this. And there was Servicemen's Bible Class, I think is what it was called. Number one was in Long Beach, number two was in San Diego, and this kind of thing. So they decided to make a trip back through the East and the Midwest with some of the key men, Dawson did, and visit their home churches and this kind of thing, and kind of minister to the homes from these men from to whom they were ministering now in the service. So they kind of wrote ahead, you know, to make a schedule out, and the word came back, well, now, who shall we say is coming? Well, who? The Bible class is coming, you know. They didn't have a real name. So they came up finally with a name, well, call up the navigators. The nautical emphasis, you know, of the sailors navigating. Just say the navigators are coming. And the thing kind of stuck. And of course, it today more takes on a spiritual connotation that, you know, we're all out on life's sea and we're sailing a course and the goal or the port is heaven, there are shipwrecked people who were to rescue. And you can carry on this nautical idea quite well. And I just might say, in my own opinion, I think God led Dawson in an unusual way to pick a name like this, because that name doesn't say anything in itself. And you know, people are always trying to pigeonhole people or organizations. You know, oh, child evangelism. Okay, you work with children. Say, yeah, that's your work. We got you pigeonholed. Now, let's see, this outfit, Christian, oh yeah, you work with Christian businessmen. And, you know, well, they try to pigeonhole you this way. Well, what does the navigator say? It doesn't pigeonhole you, for one thing. Secondly, it's from a Latin derivation, and it has a direct translation in almost every nationality of a derived form, so you don't have to redesign another name completely in most languages. There is a Latin form already in that language of the idea of navigation, and so I think it's quite helpful that way. Although we've toyed with, you know, changing the name too, because it doesn't say anything. But we've never come up with anything better. Okay. Anybody else have a question?
What was the events leading up to forming a regular organization?
Well, this happened during the war years, because you see, we had this extensive contact with men all through the armed services. And we were investigated quite thoroughly at one time because, you know, here's this outfit. They're writing each other. They're sending Bible verses. What do these things mean? Subversive, you know. Who is this outfit? How do we get a hold of it or control it, you know? So we were forced to incorporate under the laws then of the state of California for that purpose. And then secondly, we were forced to, in order to issue receipts deductible from income tax, which our government allows, you know. And those are the two reasons why we organized. But Doss was the least organization-minded person. You know, he would rather operate out of his hip pocket than to be organized. But really, the government forces you to organize. You have to, and more so in recent years, because a lot of Christian organizations have abused, you know, financially and in other ways. They've abused the privileges that the government allows them. So the government has continually had to clamp down more and more and to give account to the Internal Revenue Service and all this kind of thing. So this is really the only reason. Because actually the Navigators itself is not an organization. It's an organism. It's a family. It's a style of life. You know, it's not just an organization. And this is the way we like to keep it, really. But there's a certain amount of organization. Say, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And one of them is organization and accountability. So that's the reason why it's organized. Well, yeah, we threw everything out and tried to start from scratch. And we did quite a bit of research on memory and this kind of thing. And I think we incorporate about 9 principles of memory into the course. Like association and concentration. And it's been so long now, I almost forget all these principles that we worked on. But then... I better memorize a course here that they got on memory. But then, you know, what verses or what subjects? And you can go two approaches. You know, you can work out a nice little outline and say, okay, now what verses do you find in the Bible that fit that outline? That's one approach. And we toyed with that. But then we said, no, let's find the verses that God is using in our lives and in our ministry. And so we pulled these from many sources of our key people that have had quite a bit of experience. And, you know, you kind of juggle these around and see how they come out. And we came out with these. You have to eliminate some somewhere, but these are the ones we decided on. And so we worked from that angle. In other words, now there are a couple of cases where we did then, having got, say, one verse that was really, we thought was valuable, we had to kind of go and find another one. There are a couple of cases like that. But by and large, for the most part, it was we got the verses that we found that God was using. Now, also, we had to eliminate a few because we didn't want a duplication. We had also the Beginning with Christ booklet. So we eliminated some of those that we would maybe have included in a memory course alone. And there are a few other things like that. So we got alternate verses. But subjects that would help a person in his growth. And, of course, we tried to get the balance of intake and outreach. And it was quite an involved process. And, you know, God will use it, and somebody will come along here in a few years and get something better. Yes? Well, the primary objective is to help fulfill God's great commission by making disciples and developing disciple makers in every nation. That's the broad objective of the Navigators, to help fulfill Christ's great commission by making disciples and developing disciple makers in every nation. And the clarification, of course, in every nation in which God leads us to work, which, depending on, you know, when the Lord comes back or what, we may go into every nation. We may only go into a portion of them. We're in, say, 31 or 2 now, something like that. But the strategy is set up so that in the 1980s, we will be in a position, both geographically and with manpower bases, to go into any of these nations, other nations that God would direct us. This is the strategy. Yes?
How did you get involved
with us? Well, how I got involved was when I was in high school, starting high school, my older sister, who is Lauren's secretary here, was a Christian, and she got involved with a group that she was in, starting college then, and they were having a conference up in the mountains there in Southern California. And I better back up because I got involved a little earlier indirectly. I went to a junior high school boys' camp, and it was run by what they call the Fisherman Club, but Dawson ran the camp. He was the director, but the organization was the Fisherman Club. That's where I first met Dawson. And I had a little bit of contact with him after that camp as a junior high school boy, but then it dissipated and I didn't have any more contact. Then my sister invited me to go to this camp up in the mountains between Christmas and New Year's, and I told her, I said, Melly, I said, that's a good idea, you know, but I tried it and it didn't work. And I says, and then she kept after me. I says, well, okay, under one condition, that there's a lot of snow up there and we can go skating and skiing and that kind of stuff. So she must have prayed the weatherman, because they had a real big old snow up there. And so I went. And I was one of just a very few high schools. Most of them were college kids. And among these were two sailors who had taken off, had gotten leave, and they were a couple of the early navigators. And these two sailors befriended me, and I saw something in their lives that really attracted me. And one was Vic McCanny, and the other was Jack Armstrong. That was his name. And so up there at this time, primarily through these two sailors, I made a commitment to Christ that either it was a recommitment from before, or I don't know whether it was a first-time commitment. And they introduced me then to Dawson, who just lived a block from our high school. And then we got involved in the high school Bible clubs, and I've been involved since. Well, I think the basic thing is, of course, the emphasis that the Navs have had, and if you've heard already, is the emphasis on knowing Christ through the Word. You see, I've been reared in church, and you hear sermons, and you hear all of this, and it has a purpose, and it has a place, and good. But as soon as you start getting that spoon in your own hand and feeding yourself, you start to take off and grow. And up until then, you're kind of just floundering around. And it's when I got into this high school Bible class that But I really began to grow. Of course, I didn't know how ignorant I was until I started studying the Bible for myself. And, you know, I have some of those first study blanks back in a trunk somewhere, and I go look them up. I'm amazed at what I came up with. You know, how could you be so ignorant of scriptural things, being reared in a Christian home and all this? But it wasn't a real thing. It wasn't a personal thing. And by the way, I think this is one of the problems that we have, at least in America, and maybe you have it in Canada too, and that is where you've got a family who have been reared in the evangelical circle, maybe for a generation or two, and the kids come along, and they believe the things their parents believe, but they haven't experienced them personally. And so they get off to university or some other place. Now, maybe a lot of you don't have this background. You come out of non-Christian backgrounds. But a lot of you come out through the whole evangelical circle of things. It's a real need. How do these convictions become your own personally? And how do you experience them personally instead of just believing what your pastor says or what your parents say and all of this? Well, it comes, I think, from personal investigation of the Scriptures. You've got to get into it yourself. Then it begins to take on meaning for you, and it begins to apply to my life. But as long as we're just going along listening to it and agreeing with it, it hasn't really become personal conviction, I don't think. So I would say study, memorize, and these things, and of course the devotional life and all the basics, but the main thing of the Scriptures, I think this is why God uses any of us in the navigators. You know, there are a lot of people that are a lot more qualified in other areas, maybe. You know, scintillating speakers and abilities in this area or that. But I think why God has been able to use, quote, simple navigator people like me and others down through the years with Christian organizations and other deals is that we've had the disciplines of getting into the Scriptures. And this is God uses His Word to transform our lives and equip us. It's the equipment. And so you got to keep at the basics. And, of course, one of them is the Word. And I think this is where a lot of Christians lose out. And I know, for instance, Billy Graham feels this way. We worked with him whenever he was over in Europe, and I had the privilege of working with him in the team there for many years. I remember one time we were down in Switzerland where it was a break between crusades and we were talking and in his home there that he had for the summer. And he was mentioning, you know, that most evangelists, for instance, they can only last about 10 years of this kind of a pace that he has in evangelism. And he says, I think where they lose out is their own personal intake of the Scriptures. They start, you know, giving out. So they give out so much. And he said, I have had to intensify my own personal study of the Word of God and intake. And I think this is a secret. For instance, well, why has Billy Graham kept on as long as he had that very thing? But it's easy, and it's easy for you or me to slip up on the basics. Let them slip by, and instead of hitting those basics. Those basics are the basics, believe me. And they'll always be the basics. And, you know, some people kind of criticize the navigators for dealing with basics. Well, I hope we don't only deal with basics, but I hope we never get away from basics. Because if you do, you undermine the very foundation upon which your whole life and the whole organization and movement is built. So I would say the basics are the thing you got to keep after. So keep emphasizing that with one hand and then keep moving on with the other, but don't forget it. And many people, I think, in the organizations do. They get started with the basics, but they get forgetting the basics later on. Feel they've outgrown them, maybe. Yeah?
What has kept you consistent in the basics?
Well, I haven't always been consistent. First of all, you know, encouragement from others has been a help. You know, like when I first went to Europe and in Germany, we don't send people out. We were some guinea pigs in those days, you know. I went to Germany alone, single person, didn't know a soul, ended up over there. Well, we'll try to start something, you know. Well, we send them out in teams now and different. We've learned a few things. But in those early years, out there alone, boy, it was just the sheer discipline of getting that time. And I remember, for instance, the effects of the war were still very evident throughout Germany. And as I say, I was all on my own out there. The closest navigator was, I think, Paris or London. And you get periods of discouragement. I remember kind of homesickness a little bit, too. And I kind of subscribed to Time magazine there to keep in touch with what was going on at home. And I can remember when that thing used to come on the weekend. It would come on Friday. And I just, you know, devoured the Time magazine. It wasn't as bad then as it is now in some ways. But my own devotional life suffered on the weekends. And this was a problem to me. And I tried to kind of discipline myself in it, and I was having a real problem. So here the thing ran out, and it came up for another subscription for the new year. I prayed about it, and I says, well, nuts, you know. So I let the subscription go. And I found that I lived without it. And it helped my devotional life, too. Later on, I resubscribed when I think I had a little better control of it. But, you know, if your arm offends you, cut it off. If it's going to keep you from the basics, something better give. Whatever it is, it may be good in itself, but the good can be the enemy of the best. That's usually the way it is.
From your perspective of experience and age, what things would you have done at our age differently that we could learn from? Or what were some of the things that you did?
What would I have done differently? Well, I don't know. Yeah, see, every generation is a new breed of cat, if you know what I mean. In other words, we were still in the Depression years when I was a kid in junior high and started in high school. We were just coming out of it when I finished high school, I guess, and the war broke out and all this. But the values were different then, and it's a whole different ball game today, whether in many ways good and in many ways maybe not so good. But like evangelical, the whole emphasis of evangelicalism was just a small minority there. There was the great rift between the liberal and the conservative, the modernist thing. This was all carried on in the early 30s and throughout the 30s. And you didn't have people that were making an impact on their whole society, like Billy Graham, and all of these came later. You know, most Christians had a inferiority complex. And, of course, they had no need to. And this is one thing that Doss, didn't have at all, but and some others. But even in this area, for instance, God used Billy Graham and Youth for Christ leaders a lot to help Doss. Because Doss came out of the, you might say, the fundamentalist, narrow-minded group. And God used some of these influences, these others, to broaden out a little bit. Well, you've got that today, which we didn't have. In other words, you can pretty well carry on at your universities and all and live for Christ. And they don't give you all that much of a hard time. Now, over in Germany, they still do. They give them pretty much of a hard time. But back in those years, they used to give you a hard time. If you carried a Bible or anything like that, you know, boy, it was kind of, you were ridiculed. I mean, you are to an extent here maybe, but it isn't all that bad. But I don't know, it's hard, you can't make comparisons. And I think you have some advantages, but you have some inherent built-in weaknesses to the whole evangelical situation throughout America and maybe Canada too, that there are some danger signals. And this idea I just pointed out of personal convictions rather than secondhand convictions from your parents, or you were going to ask something else.
I just wondered if there were any unchanging principles that would always apply to you.
Well, the unchanging principles would be the basics. You know what the basics are? Okay. Devotional life, scripture memory, Bible study, prayer, witnessing, fellowship. You know, the wheel. These are the basics. And I think those are unchanging. Yeah. Any other? Yeah?
You don't have to answer if you don't like this one, but you consider personally to perhaps have been one or two of Dawson's weaknesses.
Oh, he had weaknesses. He did. You read the book, you'll see a lot of them in there. I might just say, though, before that Dawson had some things that were strengths that very few had. And most people who knew Dawson saw his weaknesses as well. But they weren't going to sacrifice the strengths that he had and could offer for getting all worked up over some of these weaknesses. And, you know, it wasn't easy for, especially like Lauren, working under Dawson. It wasn't easy. He was a hard man on himself and on others too. And he was hard in his dealings with people, but in love. It's amazing. He had a ministry, you might say, of rebuke or correction, but in love. But I think many misinterpreted this. For instance, there was a young German fellow that Dawson met, I think, in 1949 when he first went to Germany. He is just a teenager. And he'd come to Christ through a GI Youth for Christ group over there in Frankfurt. This young fellow, his dad was a Nazi officer, a major in the German army. He had seen his dad shot at the end of the war by the Austrian partisans and had to help bury his dad. He's just, I think, about 12 or 13 years of age. But he came to Christ, and Doss kind of adopted him and had an interest, as he did in many people as he meet throughout the world. But then as I was going over, he put me in touch with this fellow, Traugott. And as a matter of fact, my first night in Germany, I didn't know how to get in touch with Traugott, but I happened to meet him that night. I spent my first night or two in his home. And but we tried to help Traugott in the things of the Christian life. And he had a love, a tender heart, a love for the Lord, but he had a difficult time in the disciplines of being consistent and regular. Now, none of us is perfectly consistent. There's no question about that. But Traugott had an especially difficult time. He was disorganized, and we worked and tried to help him, and others did. One time when Doss was back in one of the Grand Crusades in London, Traugott happened to be going over to school in England, and he heard that Dawson was there, and so he went to the crusade, and he looked Dawson up. Well, Dawson took him up to the room, and after the crusade, and up to his hotel room, and talked to him, and Doss lit into him pretty hard, which Doss can do when he feels a person needs a shock treatment. But Dawson had the ability of using the knife and the oil both, which the Apostle Paul had too. He was pretty rough, but he could give the oil. And so I got this from Traugott later as he came back to Germany. He says, I was up there, and Doss says, why can't any of my guys get you down to business and, you know, and all this? And Doss was, and Traugott was such a tender little guy, he began to bawl, you know, and up in Doss's room. So Doss says, okay, Traugott, here's a piece of paper. Now I'll make a line down the middle. You write the things here on this side that you feel need to get straightened out in your life, and these other things, the things that need to be put in, you know, out and in, that idea. And I'll be back later. And he closed the door and left. Oh, Traugott thought the world had collapsed. But he told me a few minutes later, he came a knock on the door. Here came the maid with tea and cookies, you know, that Dawson sent up. Well, he said, I knew Doss loved me, see? And so this was a turning point in Traugott's life. Now, he never became a full-fledged navigator, but he became a Baptist minister over there. And as a matter of fact, he just moved his family to Texas, and he's a Baptist minister down there now. I just got a letter from him at Christmas time. He loves the Lord and living for God. But he told me this was a turning point in his life. But Doss was hard on people at times. But there was always this follow-up with love. And it was never a personal thing. Now, some people would take it personally. You know, and Doss might, if he felt a person needed it, he'd climb into him pretty hard. Well, but the next day he'd forget all about it, see? You know, that was taken care of. It, you know, it wasn't a personal thing. Doss had the ability to be very objective, which few people have that ability to do. And, of course, he was a strong disciplinarian, and he disciplined himself, and he expected results from others. That was one of the things. There were other things, weaknesses at Doss, but I think this was the main area in personal interrelations that Dawson had. He was hard on people, but if you really knew him, there was love there. He'd give you the shirt off his back, you know. And like some missionaries, Dick Hillis and some of these came from China. The communists took over. They didn't have anything. They landed in Los Angeles. Doss met him, you know, and he'd invite him over the home. Here's my wardrobe. Help yourself, you know. This kind of a person. He'd just give you anything. So he had weaknesses, and you'll see some of them in the book. But he had strengths and his love for God. And time with God, prayer, and the Word of God, and faith. He was a man of faith, to believe God and believe His promises. Like very few that I know. Okay, any other questions? Our time is just about running out. Yeah, right?
I was thinking, in light of 15 years overseas, what are some things we can do now to prepare us for the next 15 years?
Well, one of the biggest problems in going overseas, of course, is your whole cultural adaption and fitting in. Some people, and some, I don't know if you've done any reading, some feel this is the missionary gift, the ability to adapt and identify and carry on the same type of a ministry in another culture. Not everybody seems to have this gift. I think we can help ourselves in many areas by learning how to do this. And the more exposure you can put yourself to, and for instance, every country, you have minority groups. If you're interested in overseas work, I'd get involved with one of these minority groups. And of course, in Canada, you've got two distinct cultures. And I don't know if you have any relationship with the French culture, but there are problems in adapting to another culture. But this is what you have to do if you go to a non-English speaking part of the world. And if you go to, England or Australia or New Zealand, these countries, you don't have the language. There still is some cultural difference, no question. But this is a big problem in missionaries. And we are, of course, experimenting with different ways as to how give people the experience in this kind of thing before they go over. How to screen people, if possible, to see whether they have gifts in this area before going over. Because it's true that some of our people, I think we have a pretty good batting average, but some of our people have had to come back because they just haven't been able to make that adjustment. Or the wife hasn't, or the husband has, and this kind of thing. And that's one of the biggest areas that would come to mind. And, spiritually, it's just keep at the same thing in your own personal life, the basics in your own ministry where you are, because you're going to be doing the very same thing in principle over there. Now, a little different. They'll use different methods, a different approach, because it's in a different cultural context. And but the principles are the same. Another thing, I think, is to be sure that what you are doing now is based on principles from the Word and not just cultural lag from your own culture. And of course, this is a lot of Americans have gotten hung up on this. God was probably American anyway, wasn't he? And a lot of these things that have come through American culture, Christian culture, and all this, they think is biblical, and maybe it isn't. And try to sort these things out where you are. That's not saying that what Americans do, Christians do, is wrong, but to take that and say this is the biblical way of doing a thing, you've heard this, like Sunday church service Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. Why go out over to Timbuktu and make them conform to 11 o'clock Sunday morning church service? Where do you find that in the scriptures, eh? Maybe it fits our culture, but it doesn't necessarily fit theirs. But we take these things as absolutes often. And we could go into many more of them. Okay, I think our time is about up. Maybe you want to have one more. Time with God, that's all I know. I think time with God is the only thing. And, of course, this is our big problem. I know one of the things Dawson always said when we came to work, say, at headquarters. He expected a day's work for a day's wage, as it were, although we didn't get a day's wage in those days. We didn't get any. But he expected to get it put out. But he says, there's one thing you can always do. You can always get a day off or an afternoon off if you want to get alone with God. We'll never stand in the way of that. If you think you need to get out and get in the hills or something, that comes first. Okay, I think our time is really up, but it's been good sharing with you. I hope that some of this rambling of history has been interesting and maybe helpful to you.